The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So this morning, I'd like to talk a bit about concentration, samadhi. I like the word samadhi. In my mind, coming out of the Indian religions, the word samadhi is has connotations of the sacred, whereas concentration has the connotations of my teacher is telling McGill, concentrate him. And samadhi is really central to the whole unfolding of Buddhist practice and how Buddhist practice can really be a support for our lives. And it's samadhi or concentration is a doorway to a tremendous reservoir of inner wealth that sits there for you, in a sense, waiting for you. As a part of the introduction to this topic of concentration, I'd like to offer a little saying. And the saying is that for a mind which has the habit of being dissatisfied, there's never anything that is enough. For a mind that has a habit of dissatisfaction, nothing is ever satisfactory. So concentration. So in Buddhism, the word samadhi is closely associated with calm, with tranquility or serenity. I think of it as an unagitated mind. So rather than giving a definition of, you know, one-pointed focus on something, I prefer to see it as an unagitated mind. Some people define it as an undistracted mind. It's a mind which is at peace with itself, or at home with itself. And it's a mind which is composed, collected, centered, steady. There's a lot of qualities associated with the mind of samadhi. It's a mind which is said to be soft, malleable, workable, receptive, expansive, open, spacious, steady. There's many qualities that come along with it as the mind gets more and more concentrated. And also the mind has a greater capacity then, because it's settled and stable, to really stay directed at wherever we choose to keep it directed. If you have, some of you maybe have seen little babies, as I did when I was raising my kids. I was kind of amazed watching my little babies on the changing table with their backs up, seeing how completely uncoordinated their hands were and arms were, arms and legs were, just like flailing around. And I would look at these hands and will they ever be able to work properly? You know, this is it, you know, it's the end. They'll never. And then slowly, over time, they kind of, I guess children, little babies, learn enough that they have hands, and then slowly they learn how to use their hands until at some point in growing up, humans have this tremendous dexterity, right? Tremendous ability to refine work with their fingers and have a tremendous control of the fingers to focus and attention and really use it. But when I was like amazed at this flailing around babies. So the same thing is true for our minds. Our minds are just kind of flailing around. And it takes a while for some people to even learn that they have a mind. that's operating, and that's the beginning of, once you know you have a mind, it's the beginning of learning to use the mind and training the mind, and to learn greater control of the mind, the different functions of the mind, until the mind begins to have a finer and finer precision and workability, and it becomes a tool, just like the fingers can work better and better, so the mind can work better and better with control, with choice, with ability. And some of this happens naturally as the children grow and develop. There are now studies in developmental stages of children's mental capacities. And what I've read is that when babies are quite young, that they think, there's some theory, some controversy exactly how much, but some people think that babies have none or almost no ability to control their attention, and their attention just goes to whatever's happening in the environment that's loudest and focused, and so they kind of the mind wanders around. And slowly, over time, as they grow up, they get the ability to filter out what's going on in the environment, to choose and direct their attention on particular tasks, and then to be more focused. And that keeps growing, that capacity, right up into the 20s. That the ability to choose and focus and direct it on one thing and not be distracted by all the things that are distractible in the world, all the things going on. But not just in the world around us, but also in the world inside. There's all these thoughts and impulses and desires that go on. And at a young age, children have very little self-control over their impulses and desires. But as they get older and older, this gets more and more control and capacity for that. And now I have a 16-year-old at home, and I'm a bit in awe of his sense of discipline and capacity to stay focused on task and working. He works very hard at school, and probably he works with more focus and concentration at home, at least, than I do when I do my work at home. Now, it's quite impressive to see, you know, where he came from flailing out arms that had no control at all. So part of meditation practice is to continue the strengthening and developing our capacity for what in modern psychology or, I don't know, neurobiology is called executive functioning. I don't know if I like that term, but for my mind. But this ability to have to monitor the mind, know what's going on, and be able to have some control over the functioning of what's happening in our mind, our thoughts, our emotions, our feelings, so that we're not just being pushed around by the winds of the mind, winds of the world around us, that whatever has the loudest call, we direct our attention there. And in fact, what's also being shown is people have what in psychology is also called attentional bias. So we do have ability to bring our attention to certain things and hold it there, but some people have very deep-seated bias about what they bring their attention to and what they keep their attention to. Some people have a bias to look at all the dangers and all the fears. Some people have a bias to look at their desires, look at certain kinds of thoughts. There's many reasons for the so-called bias, preference why we focus on some things. But we take our ability to executive function of attention, of concentration, and direct it. There's some choice behind it, but often that choice is not beneficial for us. And the more active the mind is, the more the mind thinks a lot and is lost in a swirl of thinking, and there's no self-awareness of the thinking patterns of what's going on, the chances are fairly high that the thinking that we're doing is not nourishing us, is not benefiting us, not enhancing our inner well-being. Because the less attention we have to our inner life, the less space we have to know what's going on there, the less choice we have, and the less choice we have of what's going on, the more likely impulses which are part of the kind of, you know, the bias are operating. So part of Buddhist practice is to learn to discover that you have a mind, and then to be as. And it's a radical thing to really know you have a mind. You have a mind. Some people will complain that Buddhism is too internal, to focusing inward, and should be in the world and open up in a sense. But it's just like, you know, if I may use the analogy again of the baby with learning to use its hands, the baby first has to kind of focus on itself in order to learn how to use the hands. And then once they really learn that skill, then the hands can be used for brain surgery and all kinds of things when they grow up to be an adult. So the same thing with our mind, that there's a movement inward to learn. We have a mind and learn the ecology of our mind, what goes on in the mind, and as we become more and more familiar with our mind, understand it, then to be able to be wise about how the mind operates and what we choose to do with the mind. And one of the things that happens then is that we go inward, and then with time, then it comes out into the world in a whole different way, in a way that benefits everyone, that is connected to the world. One of the primary functions of concentration practice, there's many functions, but one of them is to create clarity in the mind and to be able to think clearly, experience it clearly, see clearly, feel clearly, to have space in the mind for clarity. And a lot of things go better when there's clarity in the mind. And so if we're able to go in and clear the mind, then when we come out to see the world, be in the world, we do so with clarity rather than continued confusion or veils that keep us from seeing clearly. So one of the things that the Buddhist tradition puts a lot of emphasis on in terms of developing samadhi or this clarity or stable mind is certainly get to know your mind, start getting interested in it. So it's a world of difference between thinking and knowing that you're thinking. It's a world of difference in having a desire and knowing you have the desire. There's that second level knowing, stepping back and seeing what goes on, that is the means by which we begin to train the mind or develop the mind or find the freedom of the mind. So one of the things we discover is the things that agitate the mind. And we're asked in this practice to become experts on all the ways in which the mind agitates itself, all the ways in which the mind gets distracted, or all the minds in which the wisdom of the mind gets covered over. And the word, there's a word that's in Pali, in Buddhist language, it's called the coverings. And the things that cover the wisdom of the mind, because they distract the mind or keep it agitated. And it's maybe a little unfortunate that in English we have translated the five coverings, as the five hindrances. They hinder awareness, but somehow people, when they hear the word hindrance, they think there's something bad in them, you know, that they somehow these Buddhists are critical of what goes on in the mind. But if you see it as the function of these five hindrances, they obscure the clarity, they obscure our seeing clearly, and they agitate the mind in a way that's actually painful. Then we understand that this is actually part of an important area to begin to get a handle of, is to look at this, because there can be no freedom, there can be no clarity, there can be no poignant wisdom while the mind is agitated. So Buddhism puts a lot of emphasis then on meditation practice and on samadhi practice to calm down the mind, to calm down this agitation. And so samadhi, concentration, is crucial. It's very important to this enterprise. Sometimes people associate samadhi with altered states of consciousness, higher states of consciousness and all that. I think maybe it's a little bit unfortunate to call it altered states of consciousness that happen in meditation practice. They're certainly different than ordinary street consciousness, with the mind being scattered and chasing after thoughts and jumping around and all this. However, I don't think of them as altered states of consciousness. I see it that the mind is becoming more and more itself, more natural, or some people call it pure. You're leaving the mind alone, so it's no longer agitated. So you get the simplicity of the mind operating in and of itself, a clear mind, a pure mind. It's the mind left alone. So it's an analogy I think many of you know is that of a muddy pond which settles. The mud settles and then the pond is clear. The clear pond has always been there, and it's the nature of a pond, I guess, to be clear if there's nothing that stirs up the mud. So it's the nature of our mind to be clear if nothing stirs it up. And so we're kind of, samadhi is a way of returning, some people call it a returning to our natural state, or returning to what's innate, or returning to something like that. So it's not altered in that sense. It's who you really are, in a sense, if you just leave yourself alone and don't have all this agitation going on. So as we get to know the mind, we have to know the distractions of the mind, the hindrances. These are things like desire, aversion, ill will, hostility, sloth and torpor, restlessness, and doubt. And last week I saw a teacher named Brian Lesage gave a wonderful analogy, a visible analogy for this. A mind which is at home in itself, mind in samadhi, and he is a mind that's like this. And he held his hand, his arm, in front of his chest, parallel to the ground, his hand straight, so it's very still. And that this is a mind that's in samadhi. A mind that's caught in desire is a mind that's like this, active working. A mind that's hostile, and it's a little different what he said, but it's like this. Either going way back, way pulling away, or going forward and striking or something. But, it's like this active doing. A mind that's is sloth and torpor is just sinking down, just collapsing. And a mind which is restless and has restlessness and regrets and agitation is a mind that's just kind of flapping, kind of lifting up and energized and maybe flapping around. And a mind that has doubt in it is everything. Just kind of, waving around and not knowing where to go and what's going on. So, but the mind that's still is quiet. The mind that's still is like the arm that's unwavering, unmoving. And in fact, an analogy that's often given for a mind that's concentrated is that of a telescope on a tripod. A tripod, it's stable, and then you can use a tripod well to see something far away. But if you're trying to look through a telescope while you're riding a train or something, you can't hold it still enough to see clearly. So how do we develop this? How do we develop a mind of samadhi, a mind of calm? I think one of the most important things that I've learned is certainly to know you have a mind, to be interested in what goes on in your mind, to track what's happening, and then bring greater interest to what's happening for you, greater interest to your practice, than the mind's interest in anything else. So, do you have any ability to choose what you're interested in? If you don't, if the mind chooses for you, watch out. But part of the mindfulness practice and concentration practice is to start getting interested in what's happening, so that the interest is so great that in a kind of way, you're not enmeshed in what's happening. You're a little bit like step back and observing it. The observational capacity of the mind, the monitoring capacity, becomes stronger than our involvement with what we're thinking about or what we're wanting. And so rather than thinking you have to kind of focus harder, look more carefully, or be more, maybe what's needed is to turn up the volume of your interest in what's happening. What's happening now? So to be interested, if you're really interested in your thinking, not thinking about your thinking, but really interested to see and to feel and experience and recognize, I'm thinking, you're not feeding your thinking anymore. You feed your thinking by being lost in it and keep thinking about it. But that ability to step back and to look and to not be enmeshed, but to look and observe and be interested, is a skill that can be developed slowly over time. Slowly, slowly, the mind gets stronger and stronger. And one of the simple ways of doing that is to use mental noting. Some people find that making a little note in the mind, thinking, or whatever's going on, but to use it, say the note, maybe say it long enough, so you begin feeling yourself stepping back enough, so you're not in the experience, not being perpetuating, not getting lost. See, this is what's going on. And then, as we become more interested in the mind, then are there ways of steadying the mind? And one of the ways to steady it is to recognize when it's unsteady, to notice. It's really fascinating to watch the mind jump around and chasing after thoughts, one thought after the other. Even if it's focused on one thing, it's like the mind that wants, or the mind that's kind of in reactive mode to what's going on. Is it possible then to somehow relax? One of the primary means for developing samadhi is in fact to relax. You can't strain yourself into a concentrated state in Buddhism. You can't strain yourself into the natural state of the mind. It's a lot about letting go, relaxing, softening. And so what is it in your system, psychophysical system, that can be softened and relaxed so the mind becomes clear, mind becomes more steady? The other thing that helps that I found is not to take too much responsibility for your samadhi. You have to offer your effort to try to be concentrated, to be present, but some of the quantum shifts that happen in the mind as you develop concentration, I don't think really we can take credit for exactly, except that we created the conditions for it. So some of you probably have the experience that maybe you sit for 45 minutes and your mind wanders off, you come back to the breath, the mind wanders off, you come back to the breath, you do it over and over again. And then maybe, for different people it's different lengths of time, but after a certain period of time, 20, 30 minutes, there's suddenly something settles or lets go or releases, and you feel that now you're more settled and you're here, and your mind is not so inclined to think so much. Or you kind of turn a corner in the mind and it becomes so glaringly obvious that it's not so interesting to keep thinking. You know, I've been thinking for a long time. It's literally, this is kind of diminishes me, or to go back into that world of thinking narrows me rather than keeps opening me up. And so there's a choice, and I don't have to do that anymore. And you can't necessarily, you know, willfully say, I don't want to do it, but as you develop the concentration and as you develop the settledness and relaxing, you come to a point where that juncture occurs, and there something releases by itself. There, maybe you start seeing there is a little bit of choice now. You don't have to pick things up anymore. Here's an interesting one that I've, in recent years, I find this very interesting about my mind. More and more, I realize that there's activities of the mind that I don't have to. You know, when the mind is working, if the mind, just use the word work, the mind works, it's thinking, and to realize, but I don't have to work all the time with the mind. I don't have to get involved in certain activities in the mind. Just let things be. So one of the things I've learned is that I find it very interesting that if someone does something that maybe hasn't affected me per se, but someone does something which I think is, make it a little dramatic, unethical. Or they've done something unethical in their life. I'm not ignoring the fact that it's unethical. I'm not going to be irresponsible about what they've done. But I'm more and more disinterested in having my mind working around their unethical behavior. Why should my mind get busy? Because they're being unethical. Why should I get busy in judging them and being critical of them and being horrified by them? And, you know, it's a lot of work for my little mind. Why should I kind of get all agitated because of what they do? And so I find myself functionally looking like I'm much more accepting of people than I used to be, because I don't want to, it's just a lot of work to do, you know, to be non-accepting. And when I'm more accepting of people or more less agitated and worked up, then there's more clarity about the situation. There's more capacity for kindness in the situation, which is more often useful than not. So I find that interesting. I hope you don't horrified by me now. You know, but this idea, why should I get all worked up, you know, about something that I can stay present and find my way through something without getting worked up. So this is an example of, as you become more aware of our mind and become more understanding of our choices we make, that we can choose to let go of things that before were, seemed automatic, seemed like this is just, of course, I mean, you didn't even, you know, just, it was obvious, I don't know, obvious, but just like, almost seemed like a natural thing to get upset at something. Then you realize, no, you have a choice, and then you leave it alone. As we have more choice, as we have more ability to be interested in, use our attention, take control of our attention and apply it, then it's possible to apply attention on particular objects of attention and keep it there, keep it rested in that, on there, or keep bringing it back to there. And that's one of the ways in which samadhi is developed. So for me, one of the primary places I put my attention to develop concentration is on the breathing. I come back, when I meditate, come back to the breath, come back to the brebreath, and be there. And then stay there. Stay with breaths over time, first a few at a time, then more and more. And as I do that, the mind becomes, or the psychophysical system becomes collected. One of the wonderful words associated with concentration, synonym for concentration, is unification. Things become unified. Collected, we become collected. We gather ourselves together rather than being scattered, all that around. And it's one of the ways, reasons I think people feel a lot of integrity in states of concentration, because they feel whole, they feel connected, they feel collected. It's a very nice feeling. And then as we get more settled in ourselves, and more collected, and we're able to stay focused on an object of attention, the mind becomes simpler and simpler. It becomes less and less agitated, or say differently, maybe you don't want to have a simple mind. It becomes less and less agitated and more peaceful. And a peaceful mind is a mind that has made space, the capacity for some of our goodness, concentrated goodness. Concentration practice concentrates goodness. Concentration practice releases and opens us to our inner goodness. And there's maybe two reasons for this. One reason is that as we get more mindful, more concentrated, more still, we're able to choose what tendencies of the mind we follow. So rather than choosing to continue to go with anger, continue to go with fear, we can choose to go with generosity, choose to go with wisdom, choose to go with mindfulness, attention to it all instead. And as we choose, most people will tend to choose what is beneficial, what is helpful. They choose that which is less agitating. Anger, fear, and thoughts and desires are agitating. And so, you know, to choose that which is less agitating. And the goodness inside of us, my experience, arises and moves through us without any agitation. So there's more choice. The other reason why goodness begins to surface more when we get concentrated is that there is a lot more clarity in our psychophysical system. There's more space for these relatively shy movements of the heart to come forth and to show themselves. We have more time and space to notice our goodness which is there. Notice that we have a tendency for kindness, or generosity, or wisdom, or patience, or love, many things that are there, and which tend to get covered over if we're agitated. And one of the reasons why they're covered over when they're agitated is I think that generally an agitated mind, even if the restlessness comes out of our bodies, A restless mind is caught up in its thoughts. And thoughts are coverings. Thoughts, if we're too much in a world of our thinking, then we're not feeling the deeper wellsprings of our heart, deeper wellspring of our goodness, which don't really come out of thinking, but come out of maybe biological feelings, instincts, genetics, something deeper inside of us. And so as we have this greater clarity and calmness and space between our thoughts, it allows for something deeper to happen. If we're only negotiating our life through our thinking, then the analogy for me is like being stuck on these four-leaf clover freeway on ramps, off ramps that goes this, you never get off. This kind of goes around and around, and you know you're stuck and just kind of spinning and spinning on this freeway. And sometimes it's rush hour traffic on that freeway. So that's the world of thinking. But to be able to step out of the world of thinking is to be able to be on some spacious country road, or get out of your car and be able to walk in the park. So samadhi creates clarity, calm. It creates a mind which is soft and workable, a mind that has choice about it. And it connects us to a feeling, a sense inside that is some of the most beautiful sense of wholeness and connectedness that the person, I think, can experience. And so I'll end with two kind of stories from my own life that maybe speaks to some of you, or maybe not. When I started meditating regularly, I started remembering things that I had forgotten from my childhood. And that's a common phenomenon. Sometimes it's unpleasant memories, sometimes it's very pleasant memories that we remember. And each of those calls for a different kind of way of paying attention to. But one of the things I started remembering was all these really good feelings I had as a child. I mean, not all, it wasn't like I had it a lot often, but these good feelings I had that nourished me at the time and were a reference point for me as I started meditating. So, oh yes, this is good, these feelings. This is a good direction. This is a good thing to have happen. One of them was taking a big bed sheet and putting it over a dining room table or a table. So you make, I guess it's called a fort, right? But I don't know how much of a fort. But so these white sheets, dangle over the side, and so, down to the floor. And you go inside under the table, and there's this very nice light coming through the white sheet, and it feels still and very safe and very kind of cozy and very like you're just kind of contained and held in a very safe place, and the world out there is, out there. And I remember, so when I started meditating, I remember this feeling of being under the table in that kind of way. And how nice it was. And then many years later, I read that in Buddhist texts that one of the images used for samadhi is a person covered with a very clean white cloth. So they didn't make forts back in the Buddhist time, but they covered themselves with white cloth. So that was one thing I remembered, was that good feeling of simple, it's very simple feeling of kind of being safe and held and quiet and calm. And then as I became a teenager, I started having some awareness of Catholic monasteries. And I don't know why I had this feeling, what the connection was, but there was a visceral body feeling inside of me of feeling calm, whole, connected, warm. It kind of a sacred feeling that kind of radiated from kind of my chest and out into the world was a feeling. And I had somehow or other in my travels around Europe, where I grew up, connecting to monasteries there or something, being around them or something. That was the only place in the world where I knew that met or resonated with this feeling I had inside. And so I had this fantasy that I was going to become a Catholic monk as an atheist. I would either not tell them, or maybe they wouldn't care. Because it was that feeling that was there. That was, in fact, when I was 18, I went to an old monastery in France, and the oldest little chapel there, center of the monastery, was, I don't know, from the 800s or something. And when I entered, I wasn't planning it, you know, it was not a planned thing. I entered into this little stone chapel, and everything got completely still. Just like, whew. You know, and there it was, that sacred feeling. It's quite something. Enough for you to believe in God. But then I discovered Buddhism, and I discovered that through Buddhism I began to understand the nature of these feelings of samadhi, the nature of the practices, the nature of how the mind works. And one of the great things about Buddhist practice, that these experiences became something that I could cultivate, develop, enhance, grow from the inside out. I didn't need to create a fort, and I didn't need to go to a monastery. Isn't that great? Maybe. No, I still think monasteries are great. But I'm happy not to be sitting under the table. So I hope what I hope this talk has done, has conveyed, is hopefully in a welcoming way, that the practice of concentration, the states of concentration, are not something foreign to you, but are there waiting for you as kind of almost like a natural state when the mind is not agitated, and that it's really the doorway or the space, the room in which some of the very best qualities of our being can come forth, can show itself. And for living a wise life, Buddhism says over and over again that there's no wisdom without concentration, without this clarity and stability of mind. And that ultimately, that you need a very stable, unagitated mind, still mind, to really experience liberation and freedom. And it's kind of like, as the mind gets very, very quiet and still and peaceful, that there's a lot of space in the mind. There's a lot of time, a lot of space, in a sense, in the mind for things to occur. And rather than being kind of overwhelmed by a lot of things happening at once or many crowded mind, there's space. And thoughts arise and they go away, and there's a pause. Feelings arise and they pass away, and there's a pause between them. Sensations, sounds, sights, they occur and they disoccur, they disappear, and there's a pause or a gap. And as you get a sense that things are not so fixed and solid as we usually take them to be, because we're riding so close with our thoughts, that there's gaps, there's these pauses, there's a rising and passing of phenomena. At some point, you might step into one of those gaps. And that's a great place. Just let go. So, okay, I hope that was okay. And it is the potluck day today, and we're ending a few minutes early. So I think it'd be very nice if we use this occasion to, if you would all welcome some neighbor sitting near you to this morning here. Even if this is your first time here ever, we're all hitting it together. So just you can welcome the person next to you, even if they've been here for years. But it's also especially nice for the new people to be welcomed. And say hello, and then you can go home, or please stay for the potluck. It's nice to be together. Thank you.